The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It's 9:15 on October 30th, 2007. We're here to take up the bill we worked on yesterday, which is SB 2001. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Huggins is here, Senator Terrio is here, myself, Senator French. And we're just wrapping up a point that came up late yesterday afternoon about joint interest billings and the repealer of two subsections of 4355-165. And we've got Mr. Bullock here from Ledge Legal to help us through that. Before we turn to you, Mr. Bullock, let me just acknowledge the presence of Senator Hoffman attending in the back and watching us with a sharp eye. Good morning, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Bullock, the concern that we heard yesterday from a representative of BP was that by repealing 4355-165 C and D, that we would somehow have sent a signal, if you will, that the commissioner would no longer have the discretion to allow or require the use of billed or billable costs. That's what I get from the memo they submitted on page 4, about the third paragraph. That seems to be the chief concern they expressed, and we want to turn to you to see whether you agree with that analysis or disagree, and give us some guidance on what happens if we repeal those two subsections. Mr. Bullock, good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Donald Bullock. I'm one of the legislative counsel in the Legislative Legal and Research Services. Anytime you repeal something, it raises the question, well, what does that mean? And in isolation, if you repealed it, then there'd be an implication that, no, you can't look at that anymore. However, you can't look at the repealed subsections of 4355-165C and D in isolation as part of a larger bill. And included in this larger bill is the amendment to 4355-165A, which is in Section 19 of the Resource Committee Substitute. And it was in Section 56 of the Governor's Bill, SB 2001. And as I read this, and I should say that these are both provisions that were introduced in the Governor's Bill by the administration, and would be in the best position to speak to their intent. But my reading of 165A is that the department is given the discretion to determine whether costs are allowable under the standards that are presented there. They must be incurred upstream of the point of production of oil and gas. I'm looking on page 16 of the Resource Committee bill, starting in line 2. The costs must be ordinary and necessary costs of exploring for, developing and producing as applicable. The costs must be direct costs of exploring for. So this doesn't preclude the department from looking at those costs. Perhaps the repeal puts less emphasis on the use of their costs, but the department's given the discretion in the amendment to 165A to put whatever's out there to see if the costs meet the criteria that are established in 165A.
One point that occurred to me after yesterday's hearing was that, and I don't know how much legal weight this would carry, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts, and that is that we just enacted the PPT scheme a year ago, and in the PPT scheme we granted the commissioner the authority to use those costs that were, or look at those costs that were in the two subsections C and D that we're now repealing. It isn't as if there's been 20 years of practice, if you will, under PPT year-to-year fights in court about what costs are allowed and aren't. And so it just struck me that by repealing it, you know, it's not as if we've sort of undone a long-standing practice. We're simply tinkering with a system that was put in place a year ago. And it struck me that there'd be a lot less weight put on how we adjust the statute now versus having adjusted the statute that had been in place for a decade or longer. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, that's true. There probably isn't a body of information yet. As far as I know, there hasn't been an audit completed of the returns that were filed April 1st of this year. As a matter of fact, under current law, they have 3 years to finally complete that audit. As far as creating the record in the legislature, the policy decisions here, with this repeal, you have a couple options. you can do what we're doing now. We're talking about the effect of the provisions, and that by putting it on the record, that one interpretation is that these continue to be things the department can consider in determining what are the ordinary and necessary costs. Alternatively, if you wanted to put a clear message, you could say in 165A that the information the department may look at for determining may include the type of things that were C and D. I don't think that's necessary, but it's up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Bullock. Other questions for Mr. Bullock? Senator Terrio.
I'm wondering if putting something into the statute would be harmful in your view or in the department's view.
If you put it in the department, you know, there's going to be a lot of appeals. There's going to be assessments. There are going to be adjustments, and there are going to be people that will object to receiving a bill for more tax and probably won't be concerned if they get a refund. But that will always be an issue. If by putting it in the statute, say the department may consider, then they'd be challenged to say, well, it says you may consider this, but why didn't you do it? Or if you did look at it, why didn't you give it more weight? Because it's not only what you can consider, but the weight that you give to each thing that's considered in the course of the audit. Mm-hmm. So if to give the department the broadest discretion to consider this, but not require them to do it, I think it's best to leave it this legislative record. Look at 165A and says that this gives the department the broad discretion to use whatever information they feel is relevant to support their assessment.
Follow up. Mr. Iverson, did you want to respond to some of the concerns that we heard yesterday from Mr. Williams?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Mr. Bullock, and I would also note that there is a point that I don't think was really fleshed out yesterday. In addition to what we've got under 165A here, being the references to billing practices or in the industry, and actually I think it was in A and now it's been moved around, but it's still in the bill. In addition, we still have the authority under the general powers of the Department of Revenue to require any information that we need in order to reach the calculation of the tax. And in addition to that, I would point out that in the reporting requirements in section 16 of the CS, under 16F5, under the monthly requirements, that also expressly references joint interest billings. So I think the argument could be made there that you know, it's certainly an item that we should be receiving, and thus we can certainly look at it to the extent that it would be useful and worthwhile and add to the audit. Would you like me to address any of the other issues as well, perhaps the 165 C and D issues?
The repealer,
if you brought up.
I mean, that's where we're on right now.
Yeah.
Sure.
In regard to that, Mr. Chairman, I would point out that there are several concerns that the department has with those sections. And first, and I've got Gary Rogers here. He's our the supervisor of the oil and gas revenue audit section. So he's really where the rubber hits the road with these audits. And he has been involved with us working through the regulations and grappling with these issues that are presented by 165 C and D. And I would point out that there are really two main areas of concern that we have. The first area of concern with these two provisions is from an administrative standpoint. And that starts with 165 C requiring a determination of, not requiring a determination, but posing the question to the department of whether the taxpayer has whether there's substantial consistency between the joint interest billings and the standards that are set forth in the statute and by the department via regulation. If the department makes that finding, so ostensibly a taxpayer would ask for that finding, we would make that finding, and then we would be referring to costs that are billable under the joint operating agreement for the basis of allowing them for lease expenditures. Under 165D, that takes that a step further and also poses the question to the department of whether, in addition to that first finding of substantial consistency with the standards, there's also the question of whether there is the substantial incentive and ability to effectively audit by the other working interest owners. This poses an administrative problem because, number one, we're looking in the past as to whether there has been substantial consistency and the incentive and ability to audit to determine the future. And these agreements are moving targets, and they're not, the accounting procedures in these unit operating agreements, joint interest agreements, are not set in stone. It would be something where we would be auditing the agreement, essentially, and then auditing the audit. So the joint interest audit. So we have a multi-track administrative problem here that is that arises from these. Would you like to add anything, Gary, to that particular piece before we move on to policy issues?
Sure.
Okay. If just to interrupt for a second, the person who's coming onto the line here, we're just wrapping up a subsidiary point left over from yesterday, and we'll be addressing the corrosion issue in a few minutes. Mr. Rogers, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Gary Rogers. I'm the production tax audit supervisor in the tax division of the Department of Revenue. Working through trying to come up with ideas for regulations to implement 165C and D, it is evident to me that we're being asked to write regulations that make subjective judgments about these agreements and whether or not there actually are industry standards in the state of Alaska. We hired consultants to look at this. They came up with a variety of agreements that they're not uniform. And it becomes, you know, one person's judgment against another is what is substantially consistent. We could probably disagree at this table looking at the same agreement and a set of joint interest billings. And so rather than create, you know, administrative fights in the future, we were kind of heading for the direction that we should maybe publish our own standard of what lease expenditures are and avoid both of these subjective. And D also makes a subjective judgment that either the auditors or the regulation drafters have to make is what is effectively auditing if the joint interest parties are auditing each other's. How do we know that's effective? How do we know? How do we define effective? How do we know that what was effective in the past is continued in the future? And we're put in the position of auditing their auditors rather than auditing the tax returns.
Mr. Iverson? Oh, sorry. Senator Huggins. And let me just, if I can hold on. Senator Wilkowski joined us a couple of minutes ago. We've also been joined some time ago by Senator Stevenson, Senator Thomas. Good morning, gentlemen. Nice to have you with us. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Gary, but having said what you did, the way the bill is presently constructed, it allows you the flexibility to look at the billing aspect, but it doesn't require you to do that. Is that accurate?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that's correct. I think any auditor auditing oil and gas lease expenditures that is subject to a unit operating agreement, whether it be a state auditor, a federal auditor, an independent outside auditor, is going to look at the joint interest billings and those unit agreements.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Iverson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to move on to the, sort of the policy concerns that we had had with these particular provisions as well. And it puts us in a very tenuous position, I think, because, you know, at some point, and we already have been asked to, we have not done any activity under this section, but the question has been raised, you know, when are you going to start moving down this path? And this really is, from a policy perspective, a concern with shifting the reins of making the determination as to what costs are and aren't allowable from to some extent, onto the taxpayer. So we move from potentially a scenario where we are debating from a trust but verify perspective, which is the normal perspective that we have, to trust us but let us verify it ourselves from the taxpayer's perspective, particularly when you get to 165D, because there we're looking at what items are actually billed. The other thing is these sections reference the final settlements, in other words, the final resolution of these claims, whether however that comes about, that are contested between the parties to the unit operating agreements and the joint interest agreements. Those resolutions aren't necessarily aligned with the state's interest. The parties would ostensibly make a resolution of their case for whatever reasons they have, but the state's not a player in that. That's one concern. Another concern is substantial compliance is not precise correspondence with the statutory standards. So there's a potential gap there. There's also a potential gap as to how this is administered between taxpayers. So there could be a different treatment of one taxpayer here as opposed to a taxpayer over here, because there is not that precise correspondence with the statutory requirements. Let's see here. I've got a couple of notes here. I actually think that pretty much sums it up. Ultimately, it's really a matter of setting a whole nother layer of ambiguity and shifting the responsibility to some extent where we don't feel that it should be. The responsibility should lie with the department, and we would propose that the additional language also buttresses that in terms of adding, giving us the affirmative responsibility to set forth affirmative regulations what is allowable cost.
I just thank you. Any other follow-up on the joint interest billings? It just strikes me that since we don't have a body of law and precedent with respect to what your practices are going to be at this stage of the game to repeal these two permissive practices in no way takes away your authority to use those if you decide to, but it doesn't bind you to them either. So I think we've had a good discussion on that point. Senator Terry.
Mr. Chairman, just to make sure I'm tracking with the discussion here, and is that the way the CS is currently written?
Senator Terry, through the chair, that's correct.
I think that does it. Thank you, Mr. Buck, for coming over on short notice. We're going to turn now to the issue of corrosion, which was the number one topic for discussion this morning. And that means that we're now in section 21 of the bill, 4355-165E, subsection 19, page 19, coincidentally. And we'll turn to you, Mr. Iverson, to walk us through your definition of corrosion. And I understand you have a special witness for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we do. This is essentially, this provision is intended to hit the same sort of policy objectives that have been expressed by the legislature, the public, and the administration that Senate Bill 80 did. It's a different take on it. And it's something that we wanted to bring up for your consideration as we move forward in addressing this issue. What this is hitting is, from our view, it's a different trigger point. It gets the auditor away from making a determination of improper maintenance or negligence, which really isn't their purview. That would be more of a legal or engineering type purview. What this looks to is if there is an unscheduled interruption of or reduction in the rate of production, or a spill or release of a hazardous substance, then the costs incurred for repair, replacement, or deferred maintenance of facilities, equipment, and structures, there is a carve-out for wells there, and I'll circle back around and explain that, then those costs would be excluded from lease expenditures, which would mean that they would be excluded from both the deduction side of the equation and then from the credit side of the equation. So this would exclude both capital expenses and operating expenses. The reason for the carve-out with the well is because there's a greater degree of uncertainty associated with wells, the geologic uncertainty and the variances in rates of production and things that can happen. There is, at the end of the section, we have put in a sort of a quasi force majeure type provision that is, to my understanding, the same provision that is actually in CERCLA. We had some assistance from some of the...
Remind us what CERCLA is.
I can't remember all the what CERCLA stands
for. You don't have to pronounce the acronym. Just tell me what it stands for.
It is the liability for environmental spills and cleanups and environmental degradation and pollution that sticks with the land. In other words, if you had a paint shop or a filling station made a mess of the property and then moved on, the owner of that property would then be liable. And this sets forth an exclusion to that sort of liability. That's where CERCLA hits in. We've taken that exclusion and inserted it in here so that unless the repair or replacement is necessary due to an act of war, an unanticipated grave natural disaster, or some other sort of phenomenon that's inevitable, as long as the effects of that could not have been reasonably prevented, or by intentional or negligent acts of a third party, as long as the operator acted with due care. So that provision also sets up a spot where if somebody comes up and shoots the pipeline, they're not going to be held to lose the deduction associated with those repairs as long as that was something that they could not have reasonably prevented. So that sort of sets us up in a fairness type situation. And then the A, B, and C of this section just sort of delineate what costs include. It also gets us into sort of the meaning of hazardous substance. This is the meaning that's set forth as a general matter with the DEC regs. We're looking at oil is included in the definition of a hazardous substance. And then replacement, including repair or renovation and improvement. In drafting this section, we did have the assistance of an advice of Pat Martindale from Martindale Consulting. He is the individual who was on the phone. If you would like to hear from him, we can do that as well.
If we've got a long distance line open to Indonesia, my interest in the state treasury says let's hear from him and then come back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Mr. Martindale, are you here this morning? Mr. Martindale.
It's a long way for that sound to travel.
I hear clicking, but I don't hear your voice, sir. We heard a portion of your voice. Try it again. Not getting anything.
He's on it. Could you ask him if he has his hotel phone on mute?
Do you have your phone on mute by any chance?
Hello?
We hear you now. Is that you, Mr. Martindale?
I can barely hear you, Dan.
I'll get closer to my microphone. How is that? Is that better?
Yes.
Mr. Martindale, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we're discussing the, I call it, I shorthand this provision, the corrosion provision, but it's obviously far broader than that. But we're talking about the corrosion provision that's in SB 2001, the oil tax bill that's in front of us.
Okay.
I understand you had something to do with the drafting of it.
I've had some discussions on it, yes.
Is there anything you'd like to tell the committee about the provision and how it would work in real life and on the ground?
I'm sorry, I'm having a little bit of problem hearing you.
I'm not sure how to. I don't know if shouting would make it any better. It's I'm leaning into a microphone, and maybe you can. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, that works.
Okay. Do you understand the question?
did. That's what I meant.
Okay, the question is, tell us about the provision you wrote for SB 2001 dealing with corrosion and other unanticipated or unscheduled interruptions of production. Well, that's usually how I like to start out, and then we'll focus in a little more narrowly as we go along. But I just wanted to get maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to be an expert in this subject, and so forth. Okay, and have you had experience in dealing with these sorts of provisions that try to exclude, if you will, the deduction of costs that are due to unscheduled interruptions or reductions in rates of production due to problems with maintenance, improper maintenance?
More of my experience has been in industry in terms of writing language that writing or interpreting or applying language to identify particular types of costs, exclude particular types of costs from an agreement or include them. It includes some work with the state of Michigan on some of the work they did in their post-production costs.
And about the language here, about the, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
I have the section 19 in front of me.
Okay. Maybe you could walk through a couple of scenarios that you believe that the bill would apply to, and the sorts of costs that you believe would be excluded by this provision.
Certainly the case that was recently in addition with the corrosion up on the North Slope would be a, an example of a repair replacement that would fall in this category.
Any other questions for Mr. Martindale from members of the committee? Mr. Iverson, is there anything you'd like to ask Mr. Martindale while we've got him here? I know it's a little unusual, but you guys have communicated more than we have, so maybe there's something you'd like to ask just to make the record complete.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to clarify that Mr. Martindale was not, he was involved from an advising standpoint.
I see.
In this statute. He wasn't actually technically drafting the provision itself. But one thing that I would like to speak with Mr. Martindale about and have him talk to is really the focus of our advice from him is how would this be audited? Because that's what Mr. Martindale does. I mean, he's a contract auditor, and that has been a consistent concern with Senate Bill 80, and I think that's probably going to be a concern here as well. So I would actually broach that topic with Mr. Martindale and ask, Pat, can you please explain how this provision would actually be audited?
Okay, I thought the last part of that, if I understand the question, is how would these provisions actually be audited? Is that the question?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Most of the companies will capture these types of costs, a repair, a replacement, this type of thing, in either an AFD project number or work order project number. Certainly anything material will have a project number with a budget associated with it. PPP remains relatively intact the way it is, and this provision is in place with it. The audits would target each of the projects identified and identifiable by the oil companies and determine whether they qualify appropriately for either these operating expense or capital expenditures. The particular project would have to be reviewed in terms of documentation regarding its purpose basically the description of the project would be the one target, and then invoices within that project number would need to be reviewed to identify really the true nature of it. It is possible taxpayer, knowing that this provision is in the code, might be reluctant to describe on the face of the project the exact nature of the project in terms of being undertaken in response to a failure problem or abandonment or an unscheduled interruption in the oil and gas flow. So some work may be required to look at the underlying vouchers and other descriptions to prove that the project is truly a legitimate deductible project under the statute, or say falls in this category of the unscheduled interruption. So it would take looking at the underlying documentation to some extent, not just a surface review.
Makes sense. Any other questions for Mr. Martindale while we've got him from Indonesia? I don't see any questions, sir. Thank you for taking time to talk to the committee this morning.
You're welcome.
Good day now.
Good day.
I have a couple of questions about the provision, and I guess the one I've been thinking about here this morning is turbine maintenance and turbine problems. If there's anything that drives oil production on the North Slope, it's gas compression and the handling of gas, and turbines are frequently taken down for one reason or another to look at vibration problems, oil problems, temperature problems, and I just wonder whether I just wonder how, even though that may be fairly small and fairly, it strikes me that that's a difficult problem to detect. It strikes me that that's a difficult problem to pick up on. Everyone knows what an oil spill looks like, but would this how narrow an application do you think this might have in looking at oil production on the slope and the problems you have in specific pieces of equipment, say, and let's just use turbines as an example.
Mr. Chairman, I think part of this question kind of goes to the underlying, there is definitely an underlying policy behind this of scheduled, proactive maintenance that's synced up with a scheduled shutdown. To the extent that a turbine, for instance, is being replaced on a regularly scheduled basis, then this provision wouldn't pick up on that. It wouldn't even be on the radar screen. If there is an unscheduled shutdown, though, that is attributable to a turbine that just blows out, then the cost of repairing or replacing that are associated with that unscheduled shutdown or reduction would be excluded under this provision. This is a to some extent a brighter line. It's a broader line than what I think SB 80 hits in terms of the potential number of events, but it gets us out of what may be a deeper hole in the sense of actually making the determinations and the fights that are going to ensue as to whether something is or isn't actually negligent or proper maintenance.
And this is a provision that's gotten a lot of attention in the public. The public's going to want to know how will we be able to tell whether or not costs that are associated with, say, a turbine fire or an oil spill, how will we know that they have not been deducted? What's the sort of the catch? What provisions allow you to turn to the public a year later and say, those were offered up as expenses, we caught them, and they've been disallowed as deductions?
Mr. Chairman, I would, to first answer that question, I would point the committee to the monthly reporting requirements. That's in Section 16 of the CS. That actually specifically requires in F3 a report of any unscheduled interruption of or reduction in the rate of oil or gas production. So that's going to be the first tip-off. In addition, we do get production reporting. So to the extent that there is a sort of an unscheduled deep blip, I guess would be the way that I would describe it, we would be on the alert then to notice that. The other question is, and this gets really into where Gary's shop comes into play, is on an audit, we would ask the question. And then, depending on the response, we would be digging further and further into that. So we've got kind of a combination of tools and ways to get at that. Would you like to elaborate any further on that, Gary, in terms of how that might show up on an audit?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think Pat Martindale explained it fairly sufficiently on the phone a moment ago that a company is normally going to establish some sort of cost center or project number or AFE or work order number to track the costs related with some sort of incident or unscheduled breakdown, and the auditors are going to look at those, request copies, and look at the backup documents for those.
But those work orders and those AFEs, I mean, they're unlikely to come with titles that alert your attention, are they? I mean, they're not going to come with a title that says repair for improper maintenance on turbine on C turbine.
Mr. Chairman, that's where your experience in doing these audits pays off, as you can recognize that you learn the language. If you know there's been an incident, if it's been publicized, which most of them are up here, because there's lots of folks looking at the slope operations, we'll know to look for something. And so even though the title may be inconspicuous, there will be, in their accounting records, a pot of dollars, if you will, with some sort of project number, label, and underlying documents and invoices and whatnot, to bring operations back in, up and running again.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think the thing that offends most Alaskans about what's happening is on the North Slope is there are companies who are acting negligently and are able to deduct those costs. This is very different than SB 80. This allows companies to be negligent and still deduct those negligent costs.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this is actually more of a strict liability type statute. So it would actually be, in my mind at least, broader from that perspective. Negligence, intentional disregard, even criminal negligence, gross negligence, those are going to be subsumed under the strict liability of if it's planned, if the reduction is scheduled, the disruption is scheduled, then they're off the hook. If it's not, then we exclude the cost.
But if I could, Mr. Chair, the difference is there has to be a shutdown. So and let me just make sure I understand this. If an organization has been negligent for years, decades on the North Slope, and they schedule a shutdown to fix that negligence, they can deduct those costs, and essentially the taxpayers of Alaska, the people of Alaska, end up paying for that. Is that right?
If it's part of their scheduled regime, then that's correct. To the extent it's not, though, for instance, with the pipeline the shutdowns in production last year, and we'll be fleshing out in the regulations the details of this provision if this passes, obviously. Those sorts of events would not have been part of a scheduled maintenance type program because it was a discovery triggered from a leak. There's a series of domino effects from there. Obviously, at some point, we'd have to draw the line as to what is or is not related to that.
I think Senator Wilikowski's brought up a good point, and I guess that's the word scheduled. We all know, or at least I know, and I assume you know, that there's annual maintenance done on turbines. You take a turbine down, you pull it apart, you bring in an expert. He look, from GE or the manufacturer, they look at the internal workings of the machine, and they tell you what. Annual sort of checkup work you need to do. And even though I guess I assume that, I don't know whether you have that body of history of historical records to know that these typically happen in this month, at this time, and so forth. And so I guess that's the first question is what body of historical knowledge do you have now that would allow you to challenge in the future whether a piece of maintenance has been scheduled or unscheduled. How would you make that determination?
Well, it's actually not whether it's the shutdown that would be scheduled or unscheduled. So we wouldn't actually be looking at a maintenance schedule, Mr. Chairman. We would actually be looking at the trigger point is whether the shutdown, and we do get information on production. So to the extent that we see some irregular shutdowns that aren't, like a typical, for instance, a typical well workover, if that's a scheduled event, it results in interruption in production, it's not going to be an issue that will be picked up here. To the extent it's not, though, the trigger point is the production dip. We wouldn't actually be looking at a maintenance plan in the first instance.
Well, let's go back to the BP spill, since that's probably the example that's in the mind of most folks in the public. An operator was out making rounds, an operator smelled oil, an operator called into the facility, the leak detection system didn't pick up on it, it was a person who noticed the spill. And what if BP said, ooh, that's bad news, hey, we better schedule a shutdown of that line and fix it starting tomorrow. Where are we now?
Mr. Chairman, it's a very astute observation. It's one that we've wrestled with internally and we're ultimately going to have to address in regulations. If the legislature, though, does feel that there needs to be an express provision in the statute as to what constitute, because you're right. I mean, I'm scheduling me dropping
right.
my pen.
Right.
Right. And then if
right.
I drop my pen,
right.
then it's right. It's out of the
if course. I'm driving down an icy hill and I can't stop my car and I see a stop sign coming, I say, well, I'm about to schedule a crash of my car into the stop sign. I can see it coming, you know, a mile away.
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair. And I think what we need to, as a department, when we're doing regulations on this, we obviously need to keep in mind there's a legislative intent here as to what's going to be, you know, really how do we implement this? And there's a certain amount of, the scheduling has to be a reasonable scheduling. I mean, we could think of a lot of examples where we could, like yours and mine, where we can say, okay, well, that was scheduled, but that's not the intent of what we're doing here.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, but on the other hand, this could be rather blunt. One of the scenarios we talked about, we take Hollis's valve company, and we just took Hollis's valve and installed it yesterday. It breaks today. It causes an interruption. You're liable. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it can be very blunt. So it's, I mean, it's, now you may be able to go to your warranty factors and all those sorts of things, but that was the thing that appealed to me about this, was it event-driven and took some of the ambiguity and some of the discussions we had about whether Senate Bill 80 provisions would get caught up in court or not, or, you know, could we really follow through based on the definitions and some of the phrases that were in the bill.
And Senator Huggins, through the chair, I think that's, you know, that's a right where we're going with this. I mean, I think we're trying to reduce the ambiguity, and it granted it picks up a range of items, but in the same respect, we're trying to get out of that sort of that those gray areas that were presented.
I guess I continue to look at this word, and I just wonder what effect you have if you take the word unscheduled out of there. You'd have costs incurred for repair, replacement, or deferred maintenance. And we'll get back to the well example. And the results in or is undertaken in response to a failure, problem, or event that results in an interruption of, reduction of, or rate of, or interruption of or reduction of the rate of oil and gas production. Why? Let's see. Undertaken in response to a failure, problem, or event. I guess that then you are back to arguing about whether the annual takedown of a turbine, you know, is deductible or isn't. That should be. That's good practice. It's good to take your turbines down and clean them out and do a detailed inspection of them. But you shouldn't be able to deduct the cost of a fire that takes place because you haven't done that annual takedown of a turbine. So I guess I can see how that sort of puts some parameters on you. And perhaps it's the regulations you are suggesting that flesh out what scheduled means and what unscheduled means.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's going to be, to answer that question, yes. And the issue with scheduling versus unscheduling goes to sort of the underlying policy I was talking about that I referenced earlier in regard to actually setting some sort of an incentive for proactive maintenance so that we keep the production coming, and with production coming, then we keep the tax revenues coming in as well.
Other questions, Senator Terrio.
So yeah, Mr. Chairman, the last scenario that you gave, if you have a turbine that goes off or they take a particular field down for scheduled maintenance, that would cause an interruption. I mean, so I don't think you can just strike that word.
Yeah, that's. I think I'm coming to the same conclusion. You've got to have some parameters.
I've just got a question, kind of a separate subject. Down on line 27, we're talking about the sort of force majeure stuff. Exceptional, inevitable, and irresistible character. That's irresistible.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I think with all these it's sort of almost redundant, I think, here, if we look at exceptional, inevitable, and irresistible. It's something that could not have been prevented, reasonably could not have been prevented. Say, for instance, an earthquake, tears out a big chunk of a pipeline, and that could not have been prevented through, good engineering practices and reasonable behavior by the operator. I think that's the sort of things that we're talking about, something that could not really have been addressed beforehand or prevented.
I think some eager beaver lawyer got a hold of that and just started adding adjectives in there until he was happy that there were enough of them. But let me talk about natural disasters for a little while. Clearly, a pipeline or a facility should be able to withstand a tremor, although that's not an active. The North Slope is not an active geological area, and this wouldn't apply to the pipeline itself, of course, because that's all downstream of the point of production. There may be a tremor or something up there. Let's just use that as an example. Where would you draw the line between, say, a tremor that you would expect any facility or building to be able to stand up to, and an earthquake that's just of the irresistible variety that knocks it to the ground?
Mr. Chairman, I think those does get us into a secondary area where that would be sort of an evidentiary matter. I mean, ultimately, once we get to distinguishing between, I don't know enough about earthquakes to say, to draw a line between what sort of level of an earthquake would get us to a point where it would inevitably rip apart any pipeline, no matter how well constructed. I think that's kind of where this is going. If it's well constructed, if it is meeting the appropriate standards, not something like the sort of expected tremors that we have here. We have tremors all the time. The facility should certainly be able to withstand that. If it is something, just a tremendous, unforeseen sort of earthquake, that would be, I suppose, that would be where this would trigger in. And if they could not have done through the use of reasonable actions, could not have prevented the damage to that, then that would be where that exclusion comes in.
And while we're building a record, let's talk about the horrible weather that sometimes afflicts the North Slope. Huge winds, cold temperatures, ice fog, and so forth. Is it your, it'd certainly be my intention that, the North Slopes, everybody knows going in that it's a horrible weather environment and you should build your facilities to withstand, minus 60 temperatures and 70 mile an hour winds and lots of ice fog. Is that your interpretation as well,
Mr. Chairman? Absolutely.
But none of those would be of the grave variety that would allow a shutdown that results from that and the cleanup costs to be charged back to the state.
Mr. Chairman, certainly not. That's correct.
Other questions from Mr. Iverson on this topic?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Senator Terry.
On lines 29 and 30, in privity of contract with. What's in privity of contract with?
Senator Terry, through the chair, that would be, for instance, an oil field contractor.
Okay. And then, line of questioning. When the debate on this topic started up in the MEGA committee or natural gas committee, I had offered amendment number 9. And part of the discussion at the time was not only about the capital costs, but the operating costs and what happens to the operating costs in a shutdown. At the time, I think it was estimated it was going to be 375,000 barrels a day would be lost in production. And there was an estimate that if there was just the flat operating cost in Prudhoe Bay is about $1 million a day. That gets spread, or a part of that $1 million attaches to every barrel that gets produced. If you have a shutdown, half the production goes away, you still have $1 million a day. So that means that those sort of fixed costs that attach to each barrel get doubled on the remaining production. Did you discuss any way of disallowing those costs to be charged to the state? Because the initial amendment tried to anticipate or suggest that through regulations there should be some way of disallowing those costs.
Senator Terry, I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
Okay. Well, I think the amendment that, or the language that you've got here in the bill, talks about an event happening and fixing it from the capital infrastructure side. You have to replace pipe or a turbine, and whether that's going to be allowed. But if you have a loss of production, that means that those fixed costs that get spread amongst all the production, they're still there. Okay, so now the state is picking up, say, double the cost on the remaining barrels. If you lost half your production, that means the remaining half has to pick up all those fixed costs. And was there any discussion about disallowing that?
Gary, do you recall anything expressly regarding that? Senator Terrio, through the chair, that express topic, as I recall, was not discussed in terms of the cost per barrel of capital expenses. However, this provision would still exclude the cap. Now, let me think about how your fixed costs.
And so they wouldn't be capital costs.
Right. Right. Well, this would exclude both capital and operating expenses.
But I don't see anything in this.
Cost, but as we drop production, though, the cost per barrel will still be, we'll still be higher because of that already sort of sunk capital.
Right.
If that's what you're referring to. So if the legislature is interested in pursuing that, that may be some additional language to consider. I'm trying to think of, this is going to be fairly broad in that the costs are going to be those that are in response to or otherwise associated with. So that's a fairly broad interpretation, and I think arguably we could pick those up, but we didn't recall, I don't recall expressly discussing that particular question.
Yeah, well, just my reading of the language is that I don't think those fixed costs are addressed with this language, and it may have been that there was no way of doing it. I'm not sure.
I don't recall that we consider that expressly. So, okay. To the extent that the legislature would like to clarify that,
we can circle around back to that. Let me turn to the subject of a well, because that seems like a big exclusion in here, and maybe you can describe exactly how well costs are treated under this provision.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. What we've got here is the carve-out for a well is would be the costs incurred for repair, replacement, or deferred maintenance of a facility, pipeline, structure, or equipment other than a well. So what we're doing here is still allowing the costs that would be associated with wells in this as a means to sort of, it's a recognition of the fact that there is a lot of uncertainty that starts getting involved in the equation once you're getting below the surface of the ground. I think that's really the fundamental drive behind that. Would you like to add anything else to that, Gary?
Mr. Chairman, I would just echo that comment. The number of things that can go wrong downhole in a well that you really can't control and you can't observe as you can with above surface equipment, that you can choose or choose not to perform routine maintenance on. It's a very different piece of equipment being downhole. And we thought to the extent it was more out of the operator's control to control those deep well events, that we weren't going to tackle that.
We're going to grant a little more latitude given the difficult nature of the operation.
Exactly.
Now, there is the back in 4355-165E, there is the sort of general prohibition that lease expenditures do not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, gross negligence, violation of the law, failure to comply with an obligation under a lease permit or license. If the drilling operation gets too far outside the bounds of normal behavior, there's going to be a cutoff point there. But in general, we're going to allow well drilling costs to be deducted irrespective of whether something goes wrong on the rig floor or downhole that causes a problem in what we would call the normal course of drilling operations.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct to an extent. There's also other provisions here as well that would still affect wells in the exclusions. This particular provision does not, but if we look at, for instance, in Section 16, costs incurred for containment, control, cleanup, or removal associated with unpermitted releases. There are still some areas where certain behaviors are going to be picked up, but the normal course of business sort of stuff is not going to be picked up.
We've been going about an hour. Why don't we take a 10-minute break? And before we do that, let me let the industry representatives know that while we've been waiting till the end of the day to discuss your concerns about individual topics, I think we're going to make an exception for this one since I know it's an item of interest, and so we can hear from you this morning, and then we can have a rebuttal from the administration, wrap it up in one chunk of time. So let's go ahead and take 10 minutes. The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. We are on the topic of corrosion. We've had a presentation from the administration on their proposed language in SB 2001, and we're going to hear from industry folks now on their concerns with respect to that language. And Mr. Williams, Ms. Crockett, good morning. Welcome to the committee. Nice to see you here. Please put yourselves on the record, and we'll be eager to hear your testimony on this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Marilyn Crockett. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. With me here today, again, is Mr. Tom Williams. Tom is the Chair of the AOGA Tax Committee, and he'll be presenting our testimony on this issue this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Good morning to you and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Williams. I'm a tax attorney for BP Exploration Alaska, Inc. I'm appearing before you today to testify in my role as chair of the AOGA Tax Committee, and just earlier to confirm for the record that the comments I made yesterday about the repeal of Section 165 C&D under the proposed legislation were as my capacity as the AOGA Tax Chair, not as a BP representative.
Understood.
Thank you. The present testimony pertains to the topic of corrosion as scheduled for consideration today. The administration's proposed paragraph 19 to be added to AS 4355-165E would, unless a situation is caused by a super force majeure, disallow any cost incurred for the repair, replacement, or deferred maintenance undertaken in response to a failure, problem, or event that results in an unscheduled interruption of or reduction in the oil or gas production, or is undertaken in response to or is otherwise associated with an unpermitted release of a hazardous substance or gas. Not only is the language of this proposed revision ambiguous and likely to lead to additional audit exceptions and possible disputes, the entire provision is unnecessary. The proposed provision states that otherwise ordinary and necessary and thus deductible costs would be disallowed if the Department of Revenue determines such costs were in response to a, quote, failure, problem, or event, unquote, that results in an unscheduled interruption of or reduction in production. What constitutes such a failure, problem, or event, and under what standards would any of these be determined? Costs associated with any temporary, unforeseen shutdown or minor interruptions, regardless how minor, could now be disallowed by an auditor even when such an event arises despite otherwise prudent and necessary business operations. Acts of individual carelessness or negligence by individuals, we can't guarantee that they're free of error. They're just humans. Yet the issue of determining what portion of any maintenance costs should be disallowed, if related to improper maintenance or production interruption, was thoroughly debated when the legislature was considering the PPT, and again in recent legislative sessions. Each time, amendments such as the one the administration is now advocating failed because of the difficulties with such subjective standards, and those difficulties were immediately apparent. The state turned to Dr. Pedro Van Meers, an international gas consultant whom the state retained, who recommended a flat 30-cent per barrel exclusion from what otherwise would be a producer's capital portion of its lease expenditures. As Dr. Van Meers explained, quote, "It should be noted that in most oil and gas fields, assets will have to be replaced after the technical life of such assets has expired. Therefore, such replacements are reasonable lease expenditures and required to protect the health and safety of the workers and to protect the environment. The U.S. 30 cents per BTU equivalent barrel is based on reasonable capital maintenance costs of fields for which I have confidential information," unquote. Dr. Van Meers further testified that, quote, "Maintenance is a reasonable deduction for PPT, but sometimes hard to decide which expenditures fall into the classification. The simplest solution is to take some base expenditure that really will be replacement, and over the next 20 to 30 years, disallow a modest floor of the capital expenditures," unquote. Now, if you assume that production is 250 million barrels a year, which is a little less than 700,000 barrels a day, the 30 cents exclusion comes to about, it comes to $75 million. That's capital expenditures that collectively the industry would incur on the slope that are going to be disallowed from either being deducted or giving rise to credits. At a 25% tax rate, that disallowance of $75 million equates to $18.75 million. And the 20% credit on that $75 million equates to another 15. So that's over $33 million a year of tax reduction that occurs because of the 30 cents disallowance. So that is, 30 cents doesn't sound like much, but $33 million a year is quite a lot. And that's the point. We believe that over time, that's, as Dr. Van Meers believe, that's going to more than be adequate for the situations you're concerned about. Now,
I want to let you conclude your remarks, and then we'll go to questions.
All right, thank you. So, Dr. Van Meers' recommendation was adopted and became Section 4355-165E18 of the PPT. The flat 30 cents per barrel exclusion sets a floor for maintenance cost and avoids the problems of case-by-case decisions as to whether maintenance, repair, or replacement is required because equipment or facilities have been improperly maintained or resulted in an unscheduled interruption. To adopt the proposed amendment while leaving the flat 30 cents per barrel exclusion in the law would result in a double disallowance of the same cost. The flat 30 cents exclusion also avoids all questions and disputes about which categories of costs were incurred due to a triggering event and are non-deductible as a result, and also disputes about how much was incurred in each cost category so disallowed. And finally, the 30 cents per barrel exclusion does apply every year, whether there's a triggering event or not. Over time, the 30 cent figure may well prove to be a reasonably accurate approximation of the average amount of costs that would be disallowed by auditing and verifying exactly which cost categories are disallowed under the proposal and how much cost is in each such category. A flat rate disallowance greatly furthers the goals of clarity, certainty, and efficiency in tax administration, enforcement, and compliance. Paragraph 19, in contrast, would undercut each one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving AOVA this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the cost of the repairs for the corrosion? What's the total cost for the corrosion repairs for BP on the North Slope?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, I need to caution the committee. Mr. Williams is here today on AOGA's behalf, not on BP's behalf. So questions directly related to his company's specific activities really aren't appropriate for him to answer wearing his AOGA hat, if you will.
Fair. Well, there was a state, I mean, I'm just, he made a statement that this is a reasonable amount, and I think that's fair game. I think that's just kind of, is that, we're trying to figure out if this is a reasonable amount, aren't we?
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, my Mr. Chairman, would you like to respond to the math that you've done earlier, excuse me, and the time over, that money over time?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. First, AOGA does not have information about what the oil transit line costs are for Prudhoe Bay. So as an AOGA spokesman, I can't answer that. But you can get an estimate for yourself. I mean, if you think back how many instances you think there have been that are of the type that are obviously of concern to this committee. How frequently do they occur? There's $33 million a year that is already of tax that's not that's being paid with respect to the disallowance of costs. And so if it was 10 years between events, you'd have $250 million that has been paid in taxes to under the 30-cent exclusion for the same purpose. You can judge for yourselves. I mean, and actually I would defer to your judgment since you're the ones who are going to have to find the balance point here, how often these risks occur.
So you're not going to answer the question?
AOGA does not have the information to answer the question, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Senator Wilkowski.
I can see the difficulty, the position you're in, representing AOGA here today, but I guess I'll just let you know we're not going to go forward until we find out the answer to the question, because I think it is relevant. The idea, of course, being that how finely tuned an instrument is this 30 cents, and does it really capture extraordinary events that will take place on the slope or elsewhere with respect to production? And I guess what I would say is this. As I look at the 30 cents, it strikes me, and we'll get Mr. Iverson back up here to respond to this idea, but it strikes me that it becomes, in essence, sort of a catch-all, that you can put lots and lots of sort of production blips off to the side and figure that 30 cents will capture them. But from time to time, there are extraordinary events, hugely expensive events that take place that everyone across the state sort of knows are outside the realm of what's normal in oil production. And at least to my mind, those are the sorts of things that we're trying to address here in subsection 19. And frankly, the oil spill on the North Slope a year ago was one of them.
Again, Mr. Chairman, all I can say is that you have a public number on the record from BP. It's Doug Sottle's letter. And I believe that was on the order of $13 million, if memory serves me, was the tax effect that BP had. Subject of confirmation, let's just say that it is the $13 million, because that's, I think, what I recall Mr. Suttle said. Here you're looking at a 30-cent exclusion that comes to a third of $1 billion over a 10-year period at 680,000 barrels a day or so. So, once again, you can judge for yourself, I think, whether that, given what's been disclosed so far, whether that's commensurate with the 30 cents or not. With respect to the actual costs, I'm not authorized to speak on behalf of BP, and that's not why I was here. And I apologize to the committee. I don't mean any disrespect or insolence or contumely or anything else with respect to the committee. I'm just not authorized to talk about those things. And if the committee, you know, insists on that, we can get someone here who could speak for the company. But I'm unfortunately not that person.
at least for my purposes, I'm going to need to know what that number is. And so we can take a break and get the number in front of us from someone who is authorized to speak. But it's important for us as we plan how this provision is going to actually work on the ground to take into account sort of the unavoidable incident that's driving this provision of law, if I'm clear. I mean, the oil spill on the North Slope a year ago is what's driving this provision. And so I think it's good for us to have that in front of us, you know, the actual numbers, to the extent that they're quantifiable.
I certainly understand your question, Mr. Chairman. And all I can say is, if you can give the chance, I'm not sure whether who's here that could, in town. But we can certainly...
We can hook them up by telephone if necessary.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Senator Terrio.
And the information that you have given us in the letter from Mr. Suttles, was that an estimate of the tax consequences at that time, or have they progressed enough with the fix that they are able to give us an idea? This is the total cost. That's been what's being reported to the state. And I guess, is there agreement with the state agencies that that is the ultimate tax consequence?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio. Mr. Suttles' letter talked about the effects during 2006.
Okay.
So that's all that it covers. Because that's what it says is all it covers. I don't have information about the remainder of your question, and I apologize for that.
Let me ask a more global question from AOGA's perspective.
Thank you.
If you had to choose between the language of SB 80 and the language that's in SB 2001, which would you choose?
If
you want to jump in.
I'm sort of feeling like, let's see, would you like to be shot with an arrow or shot with a rifle? I think in the testimony that we presented today, it's our belief that the 30 cent per barrel provides the protection that you're looking for here, and the language in both of those bills is not necessary. This is the AOGA preference.
And again, Mr. Chairman, trying to respond to your question, I'd have to go ask the tax committee which their preference is. We have not answered that specific question in preparation for this hearing.
Other questions for AOGA? Senator Terrio.
And in order for you to do that, since you're a consensus organization, all your members would have to make that choice.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that's correct.
Other questions for our witnesses? Hearing and seeing none, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your understanding of my particular awkward situation.
Other industry representatives want to testify on the language in SB 2001? Let's have the administration folks come back forward then, and we can talk about
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Iverson, I'm the Tax Director, Department of Revenue. I've got Gary Rogers here with me for the record. He is the supervisor of our oil and gas production tax audit. Revenue audit section. A few comments that I'd like to make. Mr. Williams made a few things that I think need to be clarified. The first one is, will this add another item to audit? Yes, it's supposed to. So that's the point here, is we're looking at these costs. Acts of negligence, those are included in this sort of strict liability provision. This would necessarily address, as long as there is a disruption in production, an unscheduled disruption in production or spill, this picks up on acts of negligence. That's the concern that we're going for here. There is, I do note that there is some dispute as to what the 30-cent provision is supposed to cover. There is, I believe Senator Wagner has stated that this is was originally intended to bring the tax system closer to a gross system, and that it's supposed to be covered. There have been statements made, I don't recall if Senator Wagner himself has said this, but it's supposed to cover sort of regular maintenance, things that are supposed to be done anyway. And again, I do note that there's dispute on those points.
What's your view of the 30 cents?
My view of the 30 cents is based on my reading of the record and some of the memos that I have seen and the dates on those memos from Mr. Van Muers. It seems to me that the discussions originally began with Senator Wagner requesting some discussion from Mr. Van Muers on bringing the system closer to a gross and hitting costs that would be regular maintenance. So it would be a different sort of item that this is would be picking up than what either SB 80 or HB 2001 is addressing. Another point, a few points about the logistics that I think are really worth mentioning in regard to this 30 cents per barrel exclusion. The first one of these is this is a per barrel amount. This isn't an exclusion that's addressed that's going towards negligence or unscheduled interruptions. What that means is that as production goes down, the 30 cents amount that the state gets goes down. If there's a real tension here, if it's going down because of poor maintenance practices on the slope, then the state gets actually more money taken away from state revenues because it's based on a per barrel amount. So the way that the actual calculation works is counter to saying that this is supposed to cover these items. The other thing I would point out is that 30 cents per barrel exclusion hits everybody, regardless of their behavior. And it's based on their production. So it's not going towards negligence, it's not going towards improper maintenance, it's not going towards unscheduled shutdowns in production. It is specifically just hitting, it's a blanket that hits everyone in the entire state.
It's almost a gross tax floor expressed in a different way than, say, a 5% floor or a 10% floor.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. Yes, I think that's a reasonable way to frame it. There is, and with that in mind, this 30 cents provision, if you read that side by side with either SB 80 or HB 2001, it's not a different. It's not a double disallowance because they're hitting different things. So it doesn't further that 30 cents provision does not further the policy that we're driving at necessarily. With affecting certain types of behavior that we're driving at with HB 2001 in promoting planned maintenance and planned shutdowns. It doesn't affect the same policy as Senate Bill 80 with trying to cut out costs associated with improper maintenance or poor industry practices. If the legislature wants to pursue the 30 cents per barrel exclusion, I would say, well, in that case, let's look at the costs as another way to recognize that this is not going to adequately potentially cover this sort of behavior in the first place. If we're looking at a number of, let's talk about a few numbers here, $33 million slope-wide per year. That number was thrown out as a number that's generated by the 30 cents per barrel provision. Now, I would again point out that in the future with less production, that's going to decrease. And arguably then, deferred maintenance, the costs associated with deferred maintenance are going to increase in the future. So that's not going to get us there. Another thing I would point out is that the items that I have read are that the corrosion-related pipeline costs and repairs are going to be somewhere between, I think, depending on the source, $250 to $300 million. That's going to be roughly, to my understanding, over a couple of years. If you're taking capital expenses and operating expenses, we're talking about $150 million that's coming off of tax bills attributable to that under the current regime.
because we've got 20% credits and then 22.5% deductions for OPEX CAPEX. So that's a good, that number is significantly higher than the number that is being generated under this 30 cents exclusion per barrel provision. And even over time, if we're talking time value of money, with production dropping, the net present value of that compared to the state taking a hit of $150 million in, under current times, it's going to be, in my opinion, substantially less. These are back of the envelope kind of numbers I'm thinking here. So one other thing that I would like to clarify is that, in order to meet that objective, let me circle right back onto that. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to look at my notes here, and I've got arrows drawn everywhere. One thing I would point out is that if the legislature wants to stick with that 30 cents provision, that exclusion, and I do add that that's from capital costs. I mean, it's a per barrel amount, and it excludes capital costs. That's where it's going. That could be adjusted to increased to exclude operating expenditures potentially as well, or maybe even a more realistic assessment of what the costs are, put that 30 cents up to 50 cents as an exclusion. Perhaps then that's maybe where you want to go. Now, again, I'm not necessarily advocating that position because that hits everybody. But that's an option to make that 30 cents more realistic. And then finally, I don't have the letter in front of me. I don't want to misquote the letter, but based on the testimony that I just heard, BP was saying there was a $13 million tax effect this last year, if that's correct. For them alone, I can't verify that. That was the testimony that I just heard. I would point out that that's only one of several working interest owners in that particular unit. So that, as a tax effect matter, it's only a fraction of what the actual tax effect to the state is going to be. Did you have anything you wanted to add to those points, Gary?
That's true.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Does the state know what the actual costs incurred from the corrosion repairs are?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we do not.
Do you have the right to get that information?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if we have a provision in that makes that a tax effect, in by statute, then yes, we would at audit have the right to ask that, because that would affect their tax bill. So we can get any information that we need to that's related to the calculation of their tax. If there is not an exclusion in the statute that would address those costs, now arguably, we have there to some extent there may be, because there's a gross negligence exclusion already in current law. But if we don't have something like SB 80 or something like this in House Bill 2001, my position would be that I think we're getting thin, because there's arguably not a tax effect other than just knowing the actual costs. So let me reframe that, because I'm circling back around your question. We would be able to hone in on those as a matter of generally OPEX CAPEX costs. Would we actually have a basis to define the specific pieces that are attributable to a certain type of behavior? I think we're thin there, unless we have language in the statute that actually asks us to ask about that sort of behavior.
Good follow-up, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is in the BP criminal negligence settlement agreement, the state got, I think, $4 million. Is that correct? Was it four? I believe it was $4 million.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that sounds correct, but I don't have that number actually.
And the tax effect was, from BP alone, $13 million. And then, do we have an idea of how much the tax effect was from the other interest groups, the loss to the state?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not sure exactly what the percentage of ownership is in that unit. I'm looking to Mr. Rogers to see if he has any thoughts.
One could look up the, Senator Wilkowski, you could go to the unit operating agreements and look up the particulars of each working interest owner's share We don't know. We haven't audited those periods or those numbers yet. We know, you know, there's costs receiving all this attention that we intend to look for on audit. I recall, and I think it's public knowledge, BP is about 26% ownership of Prudhoe, and so the others would make up the difference.
So the $8 million, so the $13 million, which would be BP's effect, is it fair to say is probably 26% of the total amount?
Senator Wilkowski, to the chair, I think that's probably a fairly accurate way to put
it. So we're talking about $50 million lost to the state?
50, 60, I think that's probably, and that would be for 1 year. So we also have, it's my understanding that these are supposed to span at least the course of 2 years for these sorts of expenses. So you're looking at somewhere between, I would submit, 120 to 150 million in total of a tax hit to the state by virtue of those sort of repairs.
I'm sorry, did you say 150 million?
I think potentially that would be the case. If we've got, I would say between 130 and 150 million, I mean, and the way that I'm doing the math is if you think about the overall costs of these repairs and replacements being somewhere between 250 and 300 million, those are the rough numbers that I've heard. Let's assume it's 300 million, then at, under current law, 42.5% is roughly where we are. That puts us somewhere between 130 and 150 million.
And if I could continue, Mr. Chair, would those costs be covered if we were to pass the governor's requested section on this issue?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, to the extent that any of those costs are associated with a spill, and there was a spill, or an unscheduled interruption in production, and there were those as well, then those will be excluded. At some point, we will have to draw a line as to, both in time and in scheduling, as far as how far that goes, but these certainly a portion of these are going to be excluded.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair. And just in terms of capturing this loss to the state, would the state be able to capture more of that loss, that 150 million plus loss, if we were to pass a version similar to SB 80, which includes a negligence standard, since there's been a plea of criminal negligence?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this question, since there has been a plea of criminal negligence, if there is a negligence standard that we're looking at, then I would have to look at the actual agreement, the plea agreement, to determine exactly what that covers, because one of the things that we wrestled with in the discussions with SB 80 is certainly a portion of that expense is attributable, of the pipeline replacement expense is attributable to negligence. I think we can say that, comfortably say that. Definitely gross and arguably gross negligence as well, and that exclusion is currently under the statute. The challenge with a negligence decision, though, is if they decide to replace the entire pipeline that is affected, then what percentage of that replacement would have been done anyway? What percentage is actually attributable to negligence, and do we draw that line? So I'm not trying to evade the question, but it gets fuzzy. And in terms of actual coverage, I think the language in this bill that's in the CS right now is going to be tighter in terms of precluding an argument. That said, and Senator Wilkowski, I've heard you mention on a couple of occasions about having both provisions in, and that I think you can come at it from both angles that way.
And just so we're clear, the administration supported SB 80 last session.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that's correct.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Senator Terrio, I think you had some questions.
No, I think it was clear. I was just going to point out that the $13 million was only 1 year, so we don't know what the subsequent year might be. So the number could, as the department has said, be substantial.
Senator Terrio, that's correct. And this also, I would also like to clarify one additional point to Senator Wilkowski's question earlier about in regard to what costs we would be able to see here. We would have an idea of what these costs are because they would be claiming them on their returns. But again, it's a matter of, you know, whether we have the authority to actually say, okay, what is specifically linked to this event in that through our audit process. If that event is not a matter of gross negligence, which arguably it is.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Mr. Iverson, you know, putting out information about, well, I think it's going to be this if we just do the simple math, but perhaps it'd be advisable before the committee takes action on a potential CS if we can get something a little bit more definitive the department personnel has a little time to think about it.
If you have something concrete on that, it'd be of value to us with respect to the tax consequences of the spill on the North Slope, should we not, you know, what they are in the current law, what they would be if we were to pass SB 2001.
Senator French, there are a couple of complications here. The first is that it's my understanding that this is a matter that is under investigation by the Department of Law in terms of pursuing a potential case. And so to that extent, we can't go into any speculation as to what those actual damages would be. And that would arguably be part of the damages claim. In addition, we don't know. We do not know what the costs are of that particular event. All that we know is what's been sort of bantered about, which would be, you know, we could sort of assume that.
And where does that number come from? Because I when the $250 to $300 million figure, when you mentioned that, that's a number that rang in my mind as something I must have read in the newspaper somewhere, but I don't know what the source of that was.
Mr. Chairman, as I recall, there was a letter that came out earlier this week that did reference a sum number. Now, I don't have that letter in front of me, although I think I do have some articles that came out when this incident first came to pass that may have some numbers in there.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, while he's looking for that,
What is your memory?
As I recall in resources, the number 250, and then it was an inflationary figure of 5 to 10%, but there was an inflationary figure, the question, and I think it BP was the source, either Claire or Kevin Mitchell, as I recall.
That number certainly is, yeah, the number that we're all, I think, familiar with. I was just wanting to bear down on exactly the source of it.
Well,
while we're looking for that, let me just ask this. Senator Wilkowski touched on this, but I just want to tighten it up. I guess I go back to 4355-165E, subsection 6. It's on page 17 of the CS we have in front of us. It says, costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, gross negligence, comma, violation of the law, or failure to comply with an obligation under a lease. It strikes me that with BP's guilty plea, you've just got drop-dead proof that any costs that arose from that violation of law would not be deductible. Am I interpreting that too broadly?
Senator French, we were actually discussing that this morning, and I think there's, because of this criminal negligence, I mean, on its face, that would seem to be the case. I think we could anticipate, though, an argument that criminal negligence isn't a sort of violation of a law that they would be looking for. Now, with that in mind, we need to give some further analysis to that point as to whether that would constitute the sort of violation that we're talking about here.
Well, and I guess my lawyer self also says you could come right back and say the only cost that actually arose from that violation of law was the fine I paid. That's the cost associated with the violation of law, not the pipeline cleanup or the pipeline replacement. And so perhaps that's the source of the need for the further language. Senator Wilkowski.
Well, and then furthermore, Mr. Chair, just BP is only 26% of that interest, so there's still 74% out there.
Other operators that weren't found
maybe
guilty.
Maybe not criminally negligent. But
good point. Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, for Mr. Iverson. Mr. Iverson, the inclusion of this provision in the CS was based on the assumption, and I think you stated it, that this provision is, quote, tighter than SB 80. Is that what you said?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, yes.
Okay. My follow-up. There was some discussion about the 30-cent a barrel. Could you just, for clarification, tell us what happens to that batch of money that comes from 30-cent a barrel? Where is it? What do we do with it so that people understand that provision?
I'd be happy to. Senator Huggins, through the chair. That provision is set out as an express exclusion from lease expenditures under Section 165E. That's the same provision that sets exclusions for things like gross negligence, fraud, the provision that Senator French just mentioned a few minutes ago, violations of law or lease expenditures, and there's a number of other exclusions in there. As part of that exclusion is 30 cents per barrel of capital costs. So you take your taxable production, and then you'd have which would be regular production less royalty barrels. Multiply that amount times 30 cents a barrel, and then you exclude that cost from allowable lease expenditures on the capital cost side.
Okay, so it's sitting in a fund, or it's being spent, or
Senator Huggins, actually, no, it is actually an amount that would come in with their regular tax.
Right. So it's in fact a revenue. It's not setting someplace to do maintenance about that. Yeah, I don't understand. As we talk through that, I can see how people could get confused. But I think it's important to recognize it's revenue. It's a flat tax.
Yeah. Senator Huggins,
that's a good clarification. Yeah. Thing. Yeah, absolutely. Someone has supplied me with a news story from 5 days ago, written by Steve Quinn of the AP, that says that BP. Said Wednesday that the cost to replace 16 miles of pipeline in Prudhoe Bay have increased slightly to as much as $260 million. So I think we're all right in the ballpark with respect to what the cost estimates are of the pipeline replacement on the North Slope. If the 30 cents a barrel produced, was it $33 million a year in revenue? Is that right?
The number that I, and this actually came from Mr. Williams' testimony, the number that I heard was $33 million, I think, slope-wide. I don't know if that was total area revenue or only for the slope. But yes, $33 million a year was the number that I picked up on. And Mr. Williams may be able to clarify that for you, Mr. Chairman.
So at that rate, I see Senator Wilkowski has a calculator over there, but I'm gonna use my lawyerly skills to multiply 33 million times about 7 to get 260 million.
And Mr. Chairman, one point that I would make in that is, again, we are missing out on the time value of money element of
right.
that.
Right.
So it's actually a substantially greater loss in a longer time period that would have to be accumulated.
Further questions or comments on the what we're shorthanding is the corrosion provision. But Senator Terrio.
What was your math? I'm sorry, I was reading something here.
We're not going to cross-examine me on this math.
No, the factor.
I'm just going to rule that out of order.
But what was the factor of 7, just trying to figure out how many years?
How many years it would cost to recapture the $260 million?
But the $260 million, not all of it eventually gets charged back to the Treasury, only a
Correct.
Percentage.
Correct. Anything else from the administration?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have anything else. Gary, did you have any comments? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It is 20 past 11. We've got a full afternoon of topics. Let's just take a short recess right now for scheduling purposes. We're back on the record. We have this afternoon to take up the issue of actual versus reasonable costs, but we also have we have Mr. Burnett here to talk to us about the pool that the ACES bill envisions. And so, Mr. Burnett, if you put yourself on the record and bring us up to speed on that topic, that'd be useful.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Alaska Department of Revenue. And in the original ACES proposal, there's a provision for setting up a tax credit payment fund. And I believe that was taken out in the version that came to your committee. But I'd like to go through this. The committee members have this really nice colored chart that I made, so I could talk about how we do tax credit payments now and how they would be done under the ACES proposal. Currently, there are three ways that you pay tax credits. Two, if you have a producer who has a tax liability, it's simply a reduction for their tax bill. And if you look at your chart, that shows under the production tax, just it's below that. If you have a transferable credit, those credits, that is someone who doesn't have a tax liability, they sell those credits to the producer, it reduces the producer's tax bill. So it comes right out of the production tax pool before that production tax goes to the general fund. If we have a refundable tax credit, and that's a company who has no tax liability to the state of Alaska under the production tax, but has earned credits under the production tax, those can be paid out of the general fund through an appropriation. And you'll see it's paid in the operating budget right now, the way it's done. Under the proposal in the ACES bill, which was Section 45 in the original SB 2001, rather than having an appropriation to the operating budget and then paying the refundable tax credits, the proposal is to set up a tax credit fund where an appropriation is made from the production tax prior to it going to the general fund in a percentage.
Hang on 1 second, Mr. Burnett. Senator
Lukowski? I'm trying to find the section. You said Section 45?
Section 45 of SB 2001, the original bill.
I don't think there is a Section 45.
In the original bill, not in the CS that's before this committee.
Not backslash M.
Okay, it's not. It's in backslash A, but it's not in backslash. It was taken out of the resources committee substituted.
To be dealt with in his committee.
That's not in backslash E either.
So it's not in E or M.
Let's take a short recess while we get our document. We've got the documents in front of us, and Mr. Burnett, please proceed.
Okay, so under the proposal in Section 45 of the ACES bill, their producer tax credits, transferable credits, are handled exactly the same as they are under current PPT. Refundable tax credits are paid from a tax credit fund. That tax credit fund is funded from appropriation of a percentage of production tax liability. Requires an appropriation into the fund from the legislature each year, and then the payments are made out of the tax credit fund without further appropriation, which means that the fund then can be carried forward. The balance in the fund can be carried forward. The earnings from the fund stay in the fund, and the fund would not be swept into the CBR because it's not available for appropriation because amounts in that fund do not require further appropriation to be spent.
And I think that was part of the reason why we've got you here is because that seemed like an unusual arrangement. My understanding is you've got to have legislative approval to spend money. And it struck me that this arrangement was sort of getting outside that.
Well, Senator French, it's not getting outside that. It's actually it's not a unique example. In fact, if you look what the legislature did 2 or 3 years ago when they set up the education fund, education to public schools are paid out of the formula. And the legislature has appropriated money into a public school fund, which can be spent then without further appropriation, doesn't get swept back, and it's paid under the formula that's already established. And there are, I think there are other examples of similar type funds.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. As long as, and what the way that Education Carry Forward Fund works, because the department is authorized to pay the K-12 demands of districts according to the formula, the limitation on drawing out of that fund is whatever the formula allows. And here I see the language is on, starts on page 30, that on 30, line 31, the department may, on written application of a person who has transferable tax credit, use available money in the oil and gas tax credit fund to purchase. So they are given authorization to make those purchases as people bring in those transferable credits, basically buy them back out of that fund without needing additional legislative interaction.
Right, that is correct. And that was the intent of the fund. And what one of the things that when the ACES proposal was being put together, one of the concerns that people had was that people who do not have tax liability but who are making capital expenditures in Alaska do not enjoy the same benefit on the time value of money for their tax credits as someone who has production and can reduce their tax burden and get immediate monetization of their tax credit. So using this type of a methodology, the refundable tax credit helps with that. The tax credit fund, we chose to propose that so that we would be able to ensure that there's funds there so it's more determinable as people are making expenditures. They can estimate that, in fact, the state does have money there. It's not competing with other expenditures out of the general fund at budget time. It's not looking, it's easier to track and understand how the department's budget works rather than having an amount for tax credits that varies year to year. And by using a fund mechanism, which has a distinct percentage of production tax revenues, the legislature knows how much is going into that within the realm of the estimate anyway, rather than having the current appropriation for FY08 is an amount out of the general fund, the amount required to pay tax credits under the statute. But right now it's limited to $25 million. We'll be coming into the legislature, if this doesn't pass, and with a supplemental appropriation from the general fund in the amount of probably $100 million or in excess of $100 million. But at the time we ask for that, and in fact at the time the legislature adjourns from their session, we will not know how much those credits are, because the timing of the audit of the tax returns, the audit process for the credit certificates, we will be paying those up into July and August, and we will not have a determinable amount at that point. And so we feel that this is a better way to do it. It also reduces the production tax rather than the general fund amount when you're looking at dollars and tracking, and better actually tracks with the revenue sources estimates that we do.
Let me just stop in for a moment and welcome Senator Green to the committee, who I know has been watching, and welcome, and we're glad to have you here. Senator Wilikowski.
So you're thinking this is going to cost $100 million for this section?
To the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, this section isn't going to cost anything. The tax credit fund isn't going to cost anything in and of itself. The credits, which are already in current legislation, are going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $125 million. And we already have $125 million authorization. in FY08. This section would put about $200 million into the fund if the appropriation bill also had the language section conforming to that to appropriate the money into the fund. Other provisions in ACES would likely increase the amount of that are not in your current bill but were in the bill that was introduced would likely increase the amount of credits that needed to be paid from the fund beyond the $125 million.
Good, Mr. Chair. How do you negotiate what the price is for these credits? I guess one question I have is so a company comes in and they say, we have this credit, maybe it's worth $20 million. Do you just offer them $20 million, or is there a negotiation process, or how does that work?
To the chair, Representative, or Senator Welkowski, when the state's paying refundable tax credit, it is 100% value. A transferable credit to a producer is negotiated value between the holder of the tax credit certificate and the producer. And I believe that we've had testimony and resources when I was listening that those were in the 90%+ and that there was a market. There are some companies that buy it, producers that buy them, and some that absolutely don't. So, and that's another avoidance. You know, we believe that since producers get 100% of the value of their credits, there's no advantage to the state to not give 100% of the tax value of the value of a credit to a non-producer who could transfer it to a producer, and the producer would get 100%.
Follow-up questions? Maybe we could just back up and walk me through subsection. I'm on page 30 of the original bill, / A. Just kind of walk me through the amount of money that would be appropriated to the fund in order to get it up and running. Okay. And explain how that money does not get swept, just to make the record real clear.
Okay. To do that, we'll start with section C of that, which assigns the percentage of the production tax revenue, which goes to it, to be 10% of total production tax revenue when the price for ANS West Coast is above $60, and that's certainly going to be true in FY08. So, you know, the amount under
Using your chart, 10% of this production tax value is going to get siphoned off
into that fund.
To this credit fund. Okay,
that will go into that credit fund. Then the statute, and that will go into that through a language section appropriation in an appropriation bill passed by the legislature. The fund will hold that money. It will be invested by the Treasury in probably short-term investments with most likely general fund and other non-segregated investments, GFONSI, earning 4 or 5% depending on the circumstance, somewhere in that neighborhood. Tax credits will be paid when the tax division finishes auditing a tax credit application. It will be approved. It will be sent to the fiscal section. A payment will be made out of that fund to the taxpayer. Very similar to how it's done right now, I believe. That at the end of FY08.
And how did you arrive at the 10% figure?
10%
of the production tax to get siphoned off to the...
Okay, that 10%, which is in the bill, was based on an estimate done by our economists on how, over time, what the likely value of tax credits will be relative to production tax.
And again, this is not just for those credits generated by folks who don't have production. This is for all tax credits. This is just for those.
This is just for those who have no
production
no tax liability. Production. They may well have production,
in the future,
but they won't have tax liability.
For that year.
Right. Well, they may have production for that year, but they have no tax liability for that year.
Small amounts of production.
Right.
Okay. No tax liability.
No current tax liability.
Got it.
So this year we pay $125 million out of that fund, just as an estimate. $75 million is left in the fund. Next year, same type of calculation is done, say another $200 million. And I could look at our fiscal note and say what we're really estimating, but let's just say it's right around the $200 million range. Goes into there. Next year, there may be $200 million worth of credits. There may be $250 million worth of credits. There may be $150 million worth of credits. We're hoping it's more like the $250 million in credits, because that means there's more investment being done. It's not expected to grow in a linear way over time. It's expected to be lumpy, up and down. This smooths the flow of money out of the production tax by taking a percentage out each year, and then that fund is able to pay differing amounts every year, and it carries forward. Each year it would be reported on how much is left in the fund. The legislature could make a decision to go with the 10% or a different number in the appropriation process.